Hello. I'd like to preface my talk just a couple of brief remarks. I've been here since Sunday. It's the first time that I've spoken at this conference. I've spoken all over the States and quite a number of other countries, and I have been very moved, not just by the crowd, the tremendous mix of people, but by the superb and heartfelt organization of Bob and Terry and Nicole and this absolutely outstanding support team. I think being a conference organizer is one of the most thankless jobs in the field. You work all year and essentially create a perfect dinner party where everybody comes in, has a great meal and a good time, and leaves, speakers included. We do our work, we write our paper, we come here, get our egos stroked, get paid, sell some books, and go home. I just wanted to take a moment for all of us to once again thank this extraordinary team for putting this together. Touch on one unrelated topic here. Bob was mentioning the Rendlesham Forest incident. This talk is not on that, but December was the 25th anniversary of this extremely important incident, and some of you may have seen me on the History Channel or the Sci-Fi Channel. I had tremendous problems with the way that they dealt with my co-author on the History Channel and have come back at them with all of the specifics. It's posted on UFO Updates. There'll be an article in the next issue of UFO Magazine. But if you see me sometime today and just give me your email, I will fire off my critique to you personally. Lastly, before I start, I just want to mention something I have rarely mentioned in public, certainly not in many years. Just a word on how I got involved in this field. It was not some intellectual preoccupation or I had a little sighting or something. 30 years ago, before it was the fair of talk shows and before Bud Hopkins had written Missing Time, we learned in no uncertain terms that my sister Helen was an abductee. And she was one of the first people to work with Bud, member of one of his first support groups, went on to become a very courageous advocate for folks that had these experiences. And since we lost her several years ago, one of the ways that I have of honoring her memory is continuing to do the best work that I can in this field. So I'd like to dedicate this presentation to her. This one's for you, sweetie. Lastly, some of you know I can speak extemporaneously like a Politburo member until they give me the hook and take me off 5 hours later without a note card. This talk is actually quite heavily scripted due to the nature of the particular details, so forgive me if my nose is in the paper some of the time. My degree is in the arts, and I make no claim to any formal scientific background or credentials. But many years of personal study and much practical experience have led me to conclude that one of the 20th century's most important bodies of scientific knowledge remains its most ignored, distorted, and confounded. The late author and educator and ufologist Jerome Eden used to refer to UFOs as the idiot child of the media. Nice phrase. Wish I'd thought of it. Unfortunately, the truth about Wilhelm Reich and UFOs has remained an idiot child of ufology, both here and abroad. This morning, I hope to give you as accurate an account as I'm able in the time I have of who he was, some sense of the sweep of his discoveries, his interest in and observation of UFOs, and his weather modification work, his contacts with Einstein, and how he was brought down by the American government and the Food and Drug Administration. To best appreciate, however, this account, it's very important that we view it in some context. So the whole first part of this talk is non-UFO related, but I think you'll agree, even though some of it may disturb you, it is a terribly important story, and without it in place, the ufological work will not make as much sense to you. The common functioning principle unifying the science, which Reich named orgonomy, is the study, very simply, of how energy functions in the living and non-living realms of nature. Orgonomy offers groundbreaking applications in fields as diverse as biology, psychology, meteorology, sociology, cancer research, human sexuality, child rearing, political science, and UFO studies. But some of its key findings challenge accepted physical laws. They also challenge some of society's most significant social moral underpinnings. For many, this was and remains unforgivable. During his lifetime, Wilhelm Reich was the target of establishment science, as well as attacks from both the left and the right. But his work and findings were especially reviled by communists and active Soviet agents who more than understood the danger his work represented to their cause, especially as articulated in such books as People in Trouble and The Mass Psychology of Fascism. Reich's attacks on Soviet-style communism were, and continue to be, dismissed by some as the paranoid delusions of a formerly brilliant mind. But many of his observations about the Soviets proved not only to be hyper-accurate, but prophetic. But it was Reich's acceptance of UFOs as a physical reality that dealt his professional reputation its most stunning blow. When you study the careful progression of his work and scientific investigations and discoveries, his 1953 entry into UFO studies was clearly the next logical step along a scientific path that he had strode for almost 40 years. In fact, the development of one of his most important scientific apparatuses both preceded and predicated his interest in UFOs. And let us go to our first slide, Nicole. The Cloudbuster is made up of a series of long metal pipes grounded in deep or running water by attached lengths of hollow industrial BX cable. When properly and responsibly employed, it is capable of altering weather patterns in the surrounding atmosphere. The principle it operates under is deceptively simple. And let me just illustrate it with a thought from childhood. When I was a child, if I would get like a little pimple or a boil or something, my little Russian grandmother would never, you know, put any store medicine on it. She'd cut a potato in half, and you'd hold the open end of the potato, and it would feel better. When you get a bee sting, and you've been in the Boy Scouts, you learn that you're supposed to pack it with mud, and the cool mud makes it feel better. There is something else going on. The living energy in that potato, in that mud, is actually drawing the toxins to the surface. And that aspect of drawing is the key here. The elevated pipes create atmospheric movement by drawing down atmospheric energy and harmlessly grounding it in deep water or running water. And usually the cables are submerged in a deep well. This movement is actually capable of breaking up stagnant weather fronts by attracting moisture-rich air into the area and to the locations en route of the direction as you go. I know how this may sound to some of you, but I have to tell you, I've seen a Cloudbuster demonstrated, and it was on a quiet hillside in southern New Jersey more than 20 years ago, and certainly one of the most shattering afternoons I ever remember. I saw a Cloudbuster operator change the entire complexion of the sky above me in less than 15 minutes, vaporizing clouds, moving cloud banks, and at the end, just by way of demonstration, creating a brief and momentary wind that was so intense it blew our hats off. So, for me, belief in the reality of this technology doesn't really enter into the equation. Some of these weather modification operations attracted UFOs. First over southern Maine in 1953, then above Arizona in 1954, where weeks of cloud busting culminated in what I can only characterize as a battle in the skies over Tucson. Wild as these allegations may sound, they were well documented and multiply witnessed. but I am getting ahead of myself. Wilhelm Reich was born in the Austro-Hungarian Empire in 1897. His father was a stern government bureaucrat, his artistic mother a piano teacher. Willy, as he was called as a child, and his brother Robert grew up on the family's rural estate and were educated by private tutors. On this estate, they saw regularly animals having sex, natural functioning, and he fell very quickly into a pattern of being very open to the forces of nature. Though half Christian and half Jewish by birth, Reich never practiced any organized religion and grew to observe that all organized religions tend to be the source of considerably more ignorance and suffering than enlightenment or happiness. In 1914, the Balkans erupted in flames, and over the next 4 years, World War I swept away all of what we knew of old Europe and the Reich estate. Reich served with distinction as an artillery officer in the Austro-Hungarian army until the war's end. With all of the family's holdings now vaporized, he made his way to Vienna, where he enrolled in medical school and supported himself as a tutor for the duration of his studies. He was drawn to Vienna in part because of his intense interest in the then pioneering work going on around Dr. Sigmund Freud. After graduating medical school, he not only became a pupil of Freud's, but arguably his most brilliant disciple and his first assistant for 6 years. His work as a psychoanalyst and as Freud's assistant kept him occupied till 1929. And here you see a picture of him as a member of the Psychoanalytic Polytechnic Vienna Conference, 1922. Reich is seated fourth from the left in the first row. Now, Freud and Reich parted ways in 1929 when Reich, after much clinical work and observation in the early traditional psychoanalytic tradition, presented case findings to Freud supporting his view that not most human dysfunction was based in some kind of sexual neurosis, but that all human dysfunction, misery, sadness, neuroses, had a sexual problem at its root. Freud and his followers, of course, subscribed to the theory that many, if not most, of these problems had a sexual basis. And at the same time, this was a little bit more than Victorian Vienna and Freud himself were willing to deal with, and Reich left. Reich's departure from the Freudian ranks actually created a backlash of resentment among many of his colleagues and resulted in the origin of the myth of his mental instability. It was something that would follow him for the rest of his life. You see Reich at the far left here with a group of communist sympathizers in Vienna in 1927. The young doctor and veteran became involved with the Austrian Communist Party in 1927, his intention being to marry the revolutionary mission of their idealistic and already existing mental health clinics to the restoration of happy, healthy sexual functioning in working class couples. Responsible sex education, contraceptives, were freely disseminated at the so-called sex poll, their aggregate word for sex and politics clinics. And their popularity extended from Austria, into Germany until the collapse of the Weimar Republic and then into the Soviet Union, where for a time they were allowed to thrive. Now, much to the upset, if not the horror and shock, of the communists, was that if a working couple who might have come in with ignorance or guilt or sadness or an inability to truly let themselves go in a loving embrace, if they were restored to a happy, healthy sex life, a terrible thing happened. They began to put their own happiness, the happiness of the children, and their well-being as a family above the goals of the Communist Party. Well, obviously, this was a travesty that could not be allowed to stand. And in 1934, the party expelled Reich, their rationale being that the once brilliant scientist was now manifesting symptoms of insanity. The essence of his alleged mental illness is reflected in this obviously unhinged statement. Quote, "This is what I am fighting for, the prevention of emotional human misery by the establishment of a normal and natural, that is, orgastically satisfying, human life in the masses of people." End quote. Now, to any group of individuals intent on controlling the lives and thoughts of other people, these are the words of a truly dangerous man. The party never forgave him for this, and efforts to damage his reputation and impugn his work became commonplace from 1934 on. Reich remained an avowed anti-communist for the rest of his life. Driven from Austria, then from Germany, just as Hitler consolidated power, he emigrated to Norway. Here he continued with his experiments and therapeutic practice, aided by a core group of colleagues, and devoted much of his experimental work and study to the dynamics of cancer formation in human beings. His outstanding books, The Impulsive Character, Character Analysis, People in Trouble, The Mass Psychology of Fascism, and The Cancer Biopathy, were all written during this period. He emigrated to the United States in 1939, and in 1940 was invited to be a professor at the New School for Social Research in New York City. Reich settled in Forest Hills, Queens, then a quiet district of the borough where he established a private practice, continued his writing, and refined his character analytic therapy. It's also referred to more technically as medical orgonomy. Energetic functioning in people was now his primary interest, and his key efforts were directed toward dissolving the chronic muscular contractions and armoring of his patients. This armoring, quite literally, would serve to block natural feeling and hold neurotic behavior in place. It was during this time that Reich discovered the specifically biological energy, which he called orgone, and a simple therapeutic and experimental device that could concentrate the energy and allow it to be measured in a laboratory setting. He named the apparatus the Orgone Energy Accumulator, or ORAC. The size of the accumulators Reich and his associates constructed over the years varied from that of a small box to that of a large room. A properly constructed accumulator is made up of layers, alternating layers, of organic and inorganic material. Steel wool and fiberboard were found to be ideal for the purpose. The non-metallic, organic material tends to attract and hold the atmospheric energy, while the metal, inorganic, also attracted the energy, but unable to absorb it, rapidly reflected it. As such, the exterior of an ORAC is always constructed of the organic layer, while the interior surface must be metallic. The accumulator works on the basis of what Reich termed the orgonomic potential. That is, unlike the conventional energy systems we are accustomed to thinking of in terms of, in which the energetic potential moves from the stronger system, the source, to the weaker one, orgone energy, flows from the weaker system to the stronger. Reich persevered with experiments designed to isolate and confirm the reality of this energy, but aware of the controversy an announcement of such a discovery might cause, he continued to verify his findings without seeking either public acknowledgement or official scientific verification. One of the experiments he developed was calculated to measure the heat inside of an accumulator and compare it to the temperature inside of an identically sized control box. The experiment was named TO-T. Reich and his colleagues observed that a change in the atmosphere would alter the temperature differential, and TO-T established itself to also be a reliable predictor of changes in the weather. Now, if there is any conventional explanation for this temperature differential, one that can be demonstrated under laboratory conditions, I'm not aware of it. In late December 1940, Wilhelm Reich sent a carefully worded letter about his work to Albert Einstein. arguably the best-known scientist in the world at the time. The letter, written in German, said in part, quote, "Several years ago, I discovered a specific biological energy which in many ways behaves different from anything that is known about electromagnetic energy. The matter is too complicated and sounds too improbable to be explained clearly in a brief letter. I can only indicate that I have evidence that the energy, which I have called orgone, exists not only in living organisms, but also in the soil and in the atmosphere. It is visible and can be concentrated and measured," end quote. And as I am using it, I'm sorry, that's not the end of the quote, "and as I am using it with some success in research on cancer therapy," end quote. The physicist responded by letter 6 days later, apparently intrigued enough to invite Reich to demonstrate this claim in person. The meeting was arranged through Einstein's secretary assistant, Helen Dukas, and set for January 13, 1941. That afternoon, the two men met for more than 4 hours. Reich had brought along several experimental devices to demonstrate the findings, and Einstein observed the glowing orgone energy for himself through a laboratory apparatus designed specifically for that purpose. Seemingly unwilling to believe his own eyes, the great scientist is on record as acknowledging the decided glow, but refused to rule out what he described as, quote, "the subjective factor." It was toward the end of their meeting that Reich told Einstein of the measurable heat created inside the accumulator, and then at that point their conversation completely shifted into the implications of such a discovery. Reich noted in his diary that Einstein's response had been, quote, "This is impossible. Should it be true, it would be a bomb, a great bomb," end quote. An understandable reaction, given that the heat differential repeatedly observed in this experiment violated the second law of thermodynamics, that is, that equal volumes tend to equalize in temperature. In anticipation of the meeting, Reich wrote, quote, "Orgone constitutes the field that Einstein is searching for. Electricity, magnetism, gravitation, etc. depend on its functions." Following their discussion, Einstein stated that he wanted to verify that temperature differential for himself, and Reich agreed to return to Princeton the following week with the necessary laboratory equipment. Einstein spent a week conducting and reconducting and studying TO-T, and on February 7th wrote to Reich that he had confirmed and reconfirmed the scientist's findings. The accumulator had registered an average 0.3 to 0.4 degrees centigrade higher than that of the control box. That might not sound like much, but I'm reminded of the wonderful talk that Robert Cook gave us several days ago, talking about it wasn't a matter of moving this huge bar 8 inches if it moved a fraction of an inch. Newtonian laws were out the window. But then, one of Einstein's assistants offered a simple explanation. The differential had been caused by convection. That is, the difference between the air temperature under and above the table the accumulator had been placed on. Einstein had set it on a tabletop and suspended the control box in the air. He closed his letter to Reich. "I hope this will awaken your sense of skepticism so that you will not allow yourself to be deceived by an illusion that can be easily explained. Please have someone pick up your instruments, since they are of some value. They are undamaged. With friendly greetings, A. Einstein." Stung, Reich wrote back, imploring Einstein to reconduct the experiment, but this time following the strict protocols he'd designed to eliminate such a false explanation. In his letter, Reich even describes his having repeatedly and successfully conducted TO-T with both boxes buried underground, thus eliminating any possibility of convection. But Einstein seemed to have lost all interest. Reich thought it memorable that the physicist had been so willing to accept the first explanation that had come along, and at his refusal to reconduct the experiment under properly controlled conditions. The letter ended with a plea for some respect and consideration. None was forthcoming. We don't even know if Einstein saw this letter. At the time, all of his mail would have been screened by Helen Dukas, who may have had her own reasons for not wanting her employer to confirm Reich's findings. Now, both Dukas and Einstein were put under fairly close observation by the FBI from the time they first entered this country in 1933. And while the FBI was aware of the physicists' left-leaning sympathies, they strongly suspected Ms. Dukas of being an active Soviet intelligence asset since at least 1929. There is credible evidence to support their belief, some of which I included in last November's crash retrieval conference talk on this subject, which I'm indebted to my friend Ryan Wood for inviting me to put together. I will also refer you to an extraordinary work of scholarship that I am trying to get back into print. Only 500 copies were ever printed of a wonderful book by author and researcher Jim Martin called Wilhelm Reich and the Cold War. But the evidence to support Ms. Dukas's being an active Soviet agent are overwhelming. The Food and Drug Administration, let me just close that sentence. Letters from Reich and his colleagues and from Einstein and his assistants continued to be exchanged over the next few years, but without any resolve. And these letters are available in archival form from the Wilhelm Reich Museum in Rangeley, Maine. Now, the Food and Drug Administration began to build their case against Wilhelm Reich in 1947. The red flag that had alerted them to the danger of his work that it posed to the American public was an extraordinarily vicious and inaccurate article written by a journalist named Mildred Edie Brady. The Strange Case of Wilhelm Reich appeared in the May 26, 1947 issue of the New Republic. Other biased and distorted articles followed. Time magazine's offering was entitled The Marvelous Sex Box. Brady's article was a masterpiece of distortion and attacked Reich's sex racket while trumpeting an out-and-out lie, namely that Reich had stated the orgone accumulator was a cure-all. Now, Ms. Brady was not your routine freelancer. She had a history of involvement with communist causes and was, among other things, a respected member of the drug regulation elite who actively helped to create FDA legislation as early as 1938. She was also a founder of Consumers Union, which I must stress at the time, no longer, was a communist-dominated organization that had broken away from Consumers Research Incorporated. Brady was also professionally associated with one of Reich's attorneys, Arthur Garfield Hayes, who was a sponsor of Consumers Union. There is no question that the New Republic article was clearly libelous, and Hayes' client, Dr. Reich, instructed him to initiate an appropriate libel action against the magazine and Ms. Brady. Reich's medical colleagues agreed. Incredibly, Hayes talked his client out of pressing the action, and the scientist unfortunately took his counselor's advice. This proved to be a crucial misstep. Other scurrilous articles followed, similarly devoid of responsive legal action. Hayes never even informed his client that he knew and worked with Brady, the source of this misery. And if that were not enough, Reich's other attorney, Peter Mills, would go on to become the prosecuting attorney when the case against him finally came to trial. But there was another significant factor at play here as well, and one that would have exploded on the international stage had it been known. My friend and colleague Jim Martin's tenacious investigative scholarship in Wilhelm Reich and the Cold War has established beyond any doubt that Michael Whitney Strait, a wealthy and powerful American whose parents founded the New Republic magazine, had attended Cambridge University in the 1930s and was deeply connected to and involved with the members of the legendary Cambridge Four Soviet spy ring. As the then owner of the New Republic and publisher of Brady's scurrilous article, any legal action taken against her in the publication would have easily put him under oath and on the stand. In an interview Jim conducted with Strait not long before he died, the retired publisher made it clear that he had been suffering from ongoing guilt for decades relating to his long-term involvement with Soviet intelligence and might well have come clean about his double life if anyone in officialdom had ever asked him about it. No one ever did. As such, Hayes' success in convincing Reich to waive legal action against Brady and the New Republic destroyed any trial-based possibility of revealing the degree to which Soviet intelligence had already and how deeply penetrated in by the 1940s. Now, in the early 1950s, Reich moved from New York to a rural property just outside of the town of Rangeley in southern Maine. And Nicole, let's bring up the second group of slides there. Here, he built a new home and laboratory designed to integrate both structures into a single, brilliantly practical building on a gorgeous piece of property overlooking Dodge Pond. And it is now the home of the Wilhelm Reich Museum. A student lab was soon added after the main building. This structure was the setting for the so-called Oranor experiment, a chilling example of the accumulator's undeniable ability to concentrate energy. The experiment called for the placing of a very small amount of radium in an accumulator, the unexpected results of which were to make members of the research team and participating doctors and lab assistants extremely ill, including Reich's daughter Eva. The experiment also toxified a surprisingly large area surrounding Reich's estate in southern Maine and took several months to dissipate. It was at about this time that UFOs began to appear over his property. And it was always during cloud-busting work. Reich's interest in UFOs dates from 1953. There is no written or anecdotal information that he had paid any attention at all to the publicity surrounding flying saucers previously, certainly from 1947 on. Even when in 1952, some visitors to his home and laboratory reported seeing objects in the sky that were decidedly not stars. In November 1953, though, he read one of the best books available on the subject at the time. Flying Saucers from Outer Space had been written by a highly respected and decorated World War II fighter pilot named Donald Kehoe, a name, of course, most of us are very familiar with. This retired Marine Corps major pioneered much of the basis for what we would now call modern UFO scientific UFO studies. And Reich's writings, as well as firsthand notations that appear in his copy of the book, which I had the amazing privilege of handling many years ago, indicate he was intrigued by Kehoe's observation that the maneuverability, speed, and silence of the unknowns repeatedly defied conventional laws of mechanical flight. At the time, Reich wrote, "I had not studied anything on the subject. I knew practically nothing about it, but my mind, used to expecting surprises in natural research, was open to anything that seemed real." Kehoe's book was followed by E.J. Ruppelt's report on UFOs. Ruppelt, a retired Air Force captain who had headed Air Force's Project Blue Book, prompted Reich to note, quote, "The Ruppelt report on UFOs clearly reveals the helplessness of mechanistic method in coming to grips with the problems posed by the spacemen. The cosmic orgone energy which these living beings are using in their technology is beyond the grasp of mechanistic science, since cosmic laws of functioning are not mechanical, but what I term functional. The helplessness of mechanical thinking appears in the tragic shortcoming of our fastest fighter jets to make and hold contact with UFOs. Being unavoidably outdistanced is not a flattering situation for military pride. The conclusion here seems correct. Mechanistic methods of locomotion must be counted out in coping with the spaceship problem." One night, as he sat on the back steps of his home outside in Maine, something flashed by at great speed, its behavior not suggestive of a comet, meteorite, or shooting star. Reich reported the sighting to the Air Force base at Presque Isle in Maine. It was the first of many sighting reports he would forward to them. In March 1954, he sent a copy of his survey on UFOs, and his term for them were EAs, to the Air Force. It was actually a manuscript detailing his theoretical conclusions on them as spacecraft. Now, it's important to note here that some of this material that Reich had forwarded to the Air Force made its way somehow to the FDA case files, and I think it is fair to say that, at least indirectly, the Air Force contributed to crucifying this man. Basic to the scientists' understanding of the universe was the pervasive presence of energy, implying the possibility of life in space. At this time, Reich's questioning encompassed how energy functions in the galactic currents, the formation and destruction of star systems, and the origin of the universe itself. Along with his deepening involvement in cloud busting, he now began a careful examination of the stars and set about to prove that some stars did not behave like others. The method he used in his research was nocturnal time-lapse photography. In this investigative technique, a 35-millimeter camera was carefully set to face the night sky with its shutter open. The experiment proceeded with unexpected results. Some of the stars did not produce the white lines caused by the Earth's rotation. These stars simply vanished, indicating that they were something else. He now began to wonder in earnest what they might be, and scientifically what they were doing in the skies over Maine. On October 5th and 6th, three large UFOs hung low over the southern horizon, and another hovered over the observatory on Reich's property. Reich saw the Ornor experiment with its massive pollution of the Maine area as the cause of the unknown's immediate interest in the region at the time. And if these craft had harnessed the sea of energy pervading the universe, and that was powering them, what might be the effect of training a cloudbuster on one? On October 10th, a large reddish UFO appeared just over the south end of the property. The cloudbuster was trained on it, and it moved. The unknown became less red as the device kept its aim, then moved higher and later sunk down below the horizon. Shortly thereafter, a second light appeared to the west. After 2 minutes of direct drawing, it too faded, came back, flashed, pulsated, and wobbled while moving irregularly from south to north. There was for Reich the distinct subjective impression of a struggle. It came back again shortly after, then again became fainter and smaller after drawing on it. The remaining four unknowns then removed themselves, disappearing from sight. The results of this action were both profound and disturbing. He writes in his last book, Contact with Space, I hesitated for weeks to turn my cloudbuster pipes toward a star, as if I had known that some of the blinking lights hanging in the sky were not planets or stars, but space machines. When I saw the star to the west fade out four times in succession, what had been left of the old world of human knowledge tumbled beyond retrieve. From now on, everything, anything was possible. There was no mistake about it. Three more people had seen it. There was only one conclusion. The thing we had drawn from was not a star. It was something else, a UFO. The shock of this experience was great enough not to repeat such an action until the 10th of October, 1954. While it might seem naive to some, Reich chose to address his written concerns about UFOs directly to President Eisenhower. There is a phenomena among many first-generation immigrants to this country of love for this country that is so deep that even those of us that do love this country, what is best about this country, cannot come close. And again, he thought there was no one more important to address this to than the President of the United States. He also sent material to the Air Force. The White House responded by asking him to send such future communications to the Air Force and the CIA. In Wilhelm Reich and the Cold War, Jim Martin identifies a plausible link between Reich and MJ-12. His name was Lewis W. Douglas. And again, just to insert here, last year when Ryan Wood invited me to submit a paper on this subject, of which this one is expanded, he asked me to look into any possible connections between Reich and MJ-12. Frankly, I never had. He also asked me to see what I could find on the possibility that Reich did not die a natural death. I should also say here that I was introduced to Reich's work at 19 years old, which was 7 or 8 years ago. I should also say that Reich's former first assistant, who passed in the 1980s, Dr. Ellsworth F. Baker, was my therapist for 6 years. I've met many of the people around Reich, his daughter, colleagues, biographer, and I speak with some experience here. The connection I'm about to establish aside, when I gave this paper that some of you heard in November, I thought I had drawn a direct parallel between Reich and Roscoe Hillenkoetter, MJ-12 number one, former Navy admiral, and the first director of the CIA. I want to go on record here saying that I was not correct. Hillenkoetter was no longer head of the CIA when Reich wrote to them. However, Lewis W. Douglas. Reich refers to Douglas, and this is Mr. Douglas, who wore a patch with President Eisenhower. Reich refers to Douglas briefly in contact with space as the director of the Tucson Savings and Loan, and writes that, quote, his banking institution helped along during the entire expedition in a most friendly and cooperative fashion, end quote. Douglas was also the director of research for the Institute for Atmospheric Physics, IAP, in Tucson, and a close associate and friend of Dwight D. Eisenhower's. Reich and Douglas's first contact dates from 1954, when Reich's assistant, William Moyes, attempted to contact Douglas and arrange a meeting with him. It had not been Reich who had suggested to Moyes that he get in touch with Douglas, but Charles Gardner, Jr., executive secretary of the Advisory Committee on Weather Control for the United States government. He was also the Weather Bureau's liaison with the Institute for Atmospheric Physics. Gardner had actually written to Moyes on March 21, 1955, saying, among other things, we appreciate being informed of your activities. Douglas's secretary wrote to Moyes, wrote up Moyes' calls in the form of memos. The first one reads in part, he, Moyes, had just come from Washington and had spoken to people in the Department of Agriculture, Weather Bureau, and in Mr. Gardner's office about weather control. They suggested that Mr. D., Douglas, might be interested in the information he had. But no answer was forthcoming until July 27th, at which time Douglas cabled Moyes, and Reich and Douglas began to correspond. They likely would have met and certainly spoken in Tucson later that year, but Douglas had to be hospitalized for cancer surgery during the time of Reich's visit, which I've corroborated. Jim Martin, an author and publisher, and friend Ken Thomas, have engaged in some educated speculation on the possibility of a link between Lew Douglas and MJ-12, and it is worth relating here. Douglas was known to be very close to Eisenhower and, like the president, had a pronounced interest in weather control. The Douglas-Moyes memo, so to say, is dated July 14, 1954, which is only 10 days prior to the seminal National Security Archives MJ-12 document, the Cutler-Twining memo. Now, Thomas reminds us that Robert Cutler, the author of that document, had been with the CIA as a psyops expert and also instrumental in bringing Eisenhower's, quote, Atoms for Peace program to completion. In his memo, Cutler informs Air Force General Nathan Twining, MJ-4, that a scheduled meeting is being changed and that the Special Studies Project would now meet during the already scheduled White House meeting of 16 July rather than following it as previously intended. Now, whatever the actual reason for this change, it ensured that President Eisenhower would be in attendance. Now, I'm quoting Jim Martin here. Thomas suggests that the timing of this sequence of events might indicate that Douglas, as a member of Eisenhower's quote-unquote kitchen cabinet, may have been privy to or associated with the MJ-12 group. I agree that Douglas would have been one of the most powerful men in American politics at the time that Americans didn't know about, would have known about MJ-12 if it existed. Thomas argues that Douglas, having been briefed about the meeting of MJ-12 members on July 16th at the White House, likely developed a more serious interest in Reich's plans for weather operations in Tucson on the basis of his observation of UFOs. This would have explained the sudden change in attitude on July 27, 1955, when Douglas sent a cable to Moyes inviting further correspondence. After all, Douglas had hired a man who was a former Navy intelligence officer, known to us as Dr. James McDonald, the father of scientific ufology, to head the IAP in 1954. And should be a picture of McDonald there. Visualize him in your mind. Conspiratorial musings or grounded informed speculation? I think the latter, and I'm convinced that if the members of MJ-12 had not been aware of Wilhelm Reich's UFO-related activities prior to the start of his and Douglas's correspondence, they were from that time on and would have identified the scientist as a man whose actions bore monitoring and possibly worse. As an aside, Martin definitively establishes that Reich drove through Roswell on his way to Tucson, and there is some anecdotal evidence to suggest that he remained there for a while, but it absolutely is dead-end in terms of research, and I have to state it's inconclusive. The following day, September 11th, Reich authorized William Moyes to call the ATIC, Air Technical Intelligence Command, in Dayton, Ohio, and make an appointment to discuss the seeming disabling of UFOs the previous day. Moyes was in Ohio on his way to Arizona at the time. A meeting with General Watson was agreed upon for October 14th. Over the phone, Watson asked Moyes if necessary, could their conference be continued into the evening, and how did Reich know that the UFOs had been disabled? Reich's assistant arrived at the facility early on the 14th, where he is met by a Dr. Byers, a physicist employed by the command. Byers escorted Moyes to the conference, also attended by an Air Force Captain Hill and a civilian named Harry Haberer. Asking where General Watson was, Moyes was told that he was unable to attend. Angered, Moyes left and returned to his Dayton motel. The next day, he received a call from Captain Hill conveying Watson's apologies and was asked if the report could be made to AITC Deputy Commander Colonel Wurtenberger. Moyes agreed, and the men met later that day. Reich's assistant gave an oral presentation, and all took notes except the colonel. Feeling that this had been a significant meeting and that at least some breakthrough had been made in interesting the service branch in the government, in Reich's UFO work, Moyes wrote to Reich that, quote, the contact with Colonel Wurtenberger was excellent throughout the conference. He was serious, intent, and looked at me while I talked. He was the only one who did so. His excitement increased as the report progressed, end quote. Dr. Byers, the physicist, told Moyes that he was familiar with Reich's work. Harry Haberer, the civilian in attendance, was described as someone working on the history of UFOs with the United States Air Force. Moyes continued on to Arizona after leaving Ohio. Meanwhile, Reich and his son Peter and several other colleagues were driving west as well. Each vehicle carried an appropriate assortment of laboratory equipment, and each had a cloudbuster in tow. Traveling cross-country to Arizona offered a unique opportunity to observe the sky and the land that they passed through. In author David Bodella's words, Reich's account of the 3,200-mile journey is a masterpiece in reportage on subtle nuances that he noticed in the atmosphere, in the vegetation, and in the soil on the journey. To read it is to learn how much we all walk about with our eyes shut and how insensitive we tend to be toward the emotional feel of the environment. The Tucson area had been chosen for several reasons. It was one of the world's hottest, oldest, and driest desert regions. The prairie grass, no prairie grass had grown in the area. It was had not rained a drop over the preceding 5 years, and riverbeds had all been dry for almost half a century. The team arrived at the team arrived on October 19th, 1954, and once settled in, commenced drawing operations, regularly observing the atmosphere with their meteorological instruments. Records were kept in accordance with strict scientific methods and protocols, and individual journals were also maintained. Robert McCullough, another trained Cloudbuster operator, also assisted with the operation, and Reich's daughter, Dr. Eva Reich, acted as the group's physician. Eva Reich is a remarkable woman. She's an obstetrician, probably well in her 80s now, and I think she is still practicing in rural Maine. Work began at the end of October, and many UFOs were observed over the area during the night of October 31st and November 1st. By November 7th, moisture in the atmosphere had risen from the usual 15% to 65%, an unheard-of relative humidity for the Tucson area. Drawing continued from the southern direction. The southwest direction. What they were aiming for was to draw in moisture-laden atmosphere from the Pacific, of course. On November 7th, the first clouds were forming thickly and soon covered the sky, indicating rain. Then, without apparent explanation, the clouds began to decompose. That evening, a large, bright UFO was seen coming in from the north. It moved slowly southwest until it stopped and hovered for several hours above the southern horizon. A connection between the dissipation of clouds and the presence of UFOs in the skies seemed unavoidable after this sequence of events continued to repeat itself. The Tucson-based Institute for Atmospheric Physics was founded in 1953, by the way, and once again, this is a shot of Douglas and Eisenhower, as a direct result of the formation of the President's Advisory Committee on Weather Control earlier that year. Not a surprising development, given the interest shared by Director Lew Douglas and President Eisenhower, and a number of other civilian and military officers within the administration. Douglas had appointed, atmospheric physicist to the committee as an associate director, and at some point during November or December 1954, the associate director may have met with Reich. And this is where that picture goes. His name was Dr. James E. McDonald, and we know him to be another great scientist of tremendous intelligence, courage, and passion, who, like Reich, had the temerity to attempt bringing the subject of UFOs to the serious attention of the American public, much to the detriment of both of their careers and lives. Dr. Eva Reich recalled that McDonald had visited the cloud-busting site when a TV crew came to film their operations, and that both Reich and McDonald had been interviewed for this TV report, but the interviews never aired. While it is highly probable that Dr. McDonald would have had a genuine interest in Reich's work for obvious reasons, I cannot say for sure that the two actually met and possibly talked. By November 13th, the cloud-busting operation was showing marked results. The relative humidity had risen to 67%, and foliage was now observable on mountain range that had been brown but were now green. My most favorite fact here is shortly before it began to actually rain, and those weather records are unbroken in the Tucson area to this day, without a drop of rain falling, the humidity index in the air was so high that prairie grass spontaneously began to grow for several acres around the cloud-busting site. Amazing. Okay, moisture level in the surrounding area. Rain now seemed imminent in a location which had seen none for 5 years. But then, that evening, the humidity dropped 20 points to 47%. The next day, two bright, pulsating, flashing UFOs were seen low on the eastern sky. Upon direct drawing, the first dimmed after an initial stronger blinking, then remained dim. The second wobbled, then it, too, dimmed markedly. Suddenly, a third came in from the east. Early the morning of November 18th, yet another UFO was observed on the horizon. Within 2 hours, an Air Force aircraft was seen circling the area. More UFOs continued to be observed in direct relationship to the destruction of the relative humidity. The team's operations continued to draw a moist current from the west. It had now rained in Los Angeles, Nevada, and Utah, but not quite yet in Tucson. On the morning of November 29th, Reich looked at the eastern sky through a 3.5-inch refracting telescope and observed a fully articulated cigar-shaped craft. He writes that his first reaction was to reject what he was seeing, but windows were clearly observed on the object by all present looking through the glass and recorded in Reich's drawings. The ship was observed on and off from December 1st through December 17th by Reich and others as cloud cover allowed, and charts of its movements were carefully kept. By December 14th, the atmosphere in the area at the base camp and in Tucson itself was oppressive and deadening. Just prior to this, Reich's associate, Dr. Michael Silvert, had transported a small amount of accumulator-aggravated uranium from Maine to the Tucson site. The material literally had to be towed on a cable 100 feet behind a small hired plane as its lead shielding was unable to contain its altered reaction. This was inserted into one of the cloudbusters. At about 4:30 p.m., a huge black cloud formed over the Tucson area, gradually turning a deep purple with a somewhat reddish glow. The background radiation count in the area jumped to an alarming 100,000 counts per minute. The usual background count had been holding at 600 to 800 counts per minute. Both the atmospheric and Geiger counter reactions were likely the result of the accumulator-exposed radioactive material now in the vicinity. 12 Air Force planes. Now, hold it one second. In the vicinity, yes. 12 Air Force planes soon flew over the base camp, and their contrails, made of water vapor, quickly dissolved. 20 minutes after both cloudbusters had been drawing, the skies cleared. 20 minutes. At 5:30 that afternoon, four B-56 bombers flew in low over the site, subjectively almost in a salute. At least, it was no reason for them to do it. Reich's subjective feeling was that this incident could properly be categorized as a battle. He had also come to feel that the exhaust that these craft created attacked the relative humidity and destroyed the moisture in the air. UFOs continued to be observed over Tucson throughout the rest of December, and footage of the weather modification operations was televised on the 20th. The accumulator exposed radium had now been incorporated in the cloudbuster apparatus, and the extra excitation it caused in the atmosphere seemed to have been the deciding factor in their successful results. On January 3rd, 6th, and 7th, it rained abundantly and repeatedly in Arizona, particularly in and around the Tucson area. The streets of the city were now full of puddles. The soil was completely saturated. Snow had accumulated on Mount Catalina, and 2,000 families had to be evacuated from their homes in the perennially dry riverbed. The rain then moved on to Texas and New Mexico, while the Phoenix Valley experienced a rare fog. The real cause of this anomalous weather conditions was not lost on a growing segment of Tucson residents, and a, quote, conference with local farmers, business representatives, and banking officials was scheduled for January 28th to discuss the problem of how to continue with the desert work after our departure, from Reich's notes, end quote. But a severe drop in humidity followed, as did the appearance of more UFOs, and the operations continued, with rain again soaking the area on February 17th. The following week, the Tucson Daily Citizen reported that, quote, good winter storms promise better range prospects than had been forecasted recently, end quote. Cloudbusting continued into March, as did the accompanying rainfall. Operations concluded late that month, and the team and equipment returned east in April. All of the aforementioned events were officially ignored by the Institute for Atmospheric Physics. Quoting Reich, quote, they were busy with a new project, counting the droplets condensing around dust particles per volume of air, end quote. This courtesy of a $150,000 grant from the National Science Foundation. another IAP project of the period involved the time-lapse photography of jet planes' contrails. Reich had seen and reported aircraft contrails during various cloud-busting operations and had observed their disintegration during operations in Arizona. He even wondered, quote, whether the Air Force had actually such problems in mind, end quote. They likely had. Color movie film from the mid-50s located by Jim Martin in the University of Arizona's Physics and Atmospheric Science Building shows Air Force jets being utilized in weather modification experiments. These and other findings I've related have led me to conclude that our government was very interested in Dr. Reich's weather UFO observations, weather work, and his findings relative to working with the Cloudbuster, from the president on down. And while it may have been a coincidence, in late November 1955, President Eisenhower's Atoms for Peace proposal, a plan for the peaceful use of atomic energy, was accepted by the United Nations. It even resulted in a beautiful little blue American stamp of the period, Atoms for Peace. Some months prior to this, Reich had sent Eisenhower a copy of his paper documenting the Oranor experiment and the operations and experiments that had sprung from it. The paper was titled, obviously coincidentally, Atoms for Peace. I should also digress here and say that there is strong anecdotal evidence to support a meeting between Dr. Reich and President Eisenhower in rural Maine at a time when President Eisenhower's schedule was completely clear of obligations and when he was not in Washington, D.C. and was in southern Maine on a quote-unquote fishing trip. I cannot corroborate this, but it is possible. Reich's contempt trial could easily be made the subject of a longer talk than the one I am giving right now, but here are the basics of what transpired. The FDA, as you'll recall, first became interested in him shortly after Mildred Brady's article appeared in 1947. But making the case stick was proving relatively difficult. Absolutely none of Reich's past or current patients, nor any of the patients seeing the other physicians Reich had trained in medical orgone therapy, had ever registered a complaint to the FDA, or for that matter with any other agency. Neither had Reich or his associates broken any laws, but the FDA remained undeterred in their efforts. After all, they knew he was a fraud and saw their responsibility as bringing this sex-obsessed medical menace to justice. So it was that the Food and Drug Administration went to federal court and brought a complaint against the interstate shipment of orgone energy accumulators, or any other related therapeutic materials. Their big break came in 1955 when the physician who had accompanied the irradiated material out to Arizona, Dr. Michael Silvert, either through absent-mindedness, terrible forgetfulness, just human frailty, shipped an orgone energy accumulator interstate out of Maine to New York. Now, they could not touch them in Maine, but once this device, which they declared a quackery, had crossed state lines, they had broken a new federal law. And upon consideration, Reich decided, even though he was in Arizona at the time, that he should take personal responsibility and take Dr. Silvert off the hook. He then wrote to the judge explaining his decision, noting he was aware that his argument might be rejected. It was, and the violation stood. FDA agents began appearing at this point on Reich's main property, but he refused to allow them any access to his scientific equipment or written materials, and continued on with his experiments. This resulted in a contempt of court citation. Now, while their original legal parry had been a civil matter, it had now graduated to become a criminal action, and the court date was set. The betrayal of both of his lawyers likely influenced Reich's decision to represent himself in court. This was against the advice of his closest associates, especially as he had decided to make the trial a forum for the validity of his research and findings, a courageous but very naive and unfortunately destructive decision. Eloquent though he was, the judge would have none of it. In May of 56, Wilhelm Reich was convicted of contempt of court and sentenced to 2 years in Lewisburg Federal Penitentiary in Pennsylvania. He was 59 years old. Beginning that year and continuing into the final months of the Eisenhower administration, the Food and Drug Administration confiscated and burned more than 8 tons of Reich's hardcover books, scientific journals, and any other assorted work that even mentioned orgone energy on the flyleaf. The FDA's only criteria was that appearance of that phrase, orgone energy, anywhere in the text. Editions of books having nothing to do with the subject were burned because it appeared on the jacket promoting another book. To the best of our knowledge, all of the above came to pass without the FDA ever once attempting to replicate any of Reich's experiments, build an accumulator, build a cloud buster. It just never happened. Reich, as you may imagine, had a pretty hefty FBI file and an FBI memorandum directed to J. Edgar Hoover 2 months into Reich's prison term toes the party line, noting, quote, Reich was found guilty of contempt of court following the issuance of an injunction barring interstate shipment of device, literature, and promotional materials regarding treatment by Reich of cancer and other serious diseases, said devices having been described as worthless by the Food and Drug Administration, end quote. The document contains no reference to UFOs, so it's interesting to note that its lead line is civilian research, interplanetary flying objects. Once incarcerated, prison authorities determined that the new inmate should undergo a psychiatric evaluation. Staff psychiatrists noted that he gave no concrete evidence of being mentally incompetent, but officially diagnosed him as suffering from paranoid schizophrenia anyway. This while admitting their findings were, quote, not based on physical evaluation, end quote. Early release was denied him, and the Supreme Court chose not to comment on his final writ. Dr. Baker told me at one point that on his last visit to Reich in prison with his wife and I think daughter, Reich showed him a manuscript for what would have been his latest book. It was called Creation, and Dr. Baker, who was a brilliant, modest, self-effacing man, one of the greatest men I've ever met, described it as containing anti-gravity equations and that it was the most farsighted piece of work he had ever seen Reich produce. Wilhelm Reich was found dead in his cell at Lewisburg on November 3, 1957, just 7 days prior to his scheduled release. The manuscript for Contact was missing. The account I've related to you here this morning represents only the briefest sketch of the events and the actions I've discussed here. Let's go to the next slide, please. I'm really coming down to the line on time here, so let me jump ahead here. Since his death, most accounts of Dr. Reich's life and work, be they supportive or otherwise, follow a similar logic, that the level of importance which he ascribed to the UFO observations were in themselves a means of proving or at least suggesting that he had gone quite mad during his last years. In contact with space, Reich dares to ask, as a scientist, to exercise a most precious right, the right to challenge an established and accepted belief, the right to think a thought, no matter how others might perceive it, recording that thought for publication and standing by it in the face of almost universal criticism. But apparently, the very act of claiming to have observed UFOs and over time their behavior, interacting with them via the Cloudbuster, ascribing to them intelligence and intention, keeping the Air Force and CIA, National Weather Bureau, the Office of the President, appraised of his activities, and finally the posthumous publication, in an edition of 500, of Contact with Space, proved intolerable to all but a few. Do Wilhelm Reich's observations, deductions, and conclusions concerning UFOs all conform to the best contemporary knowledge on the subject? The majority of them do. And his citing reports and observations are virtually identical to those made by countless individuals both now and then. Is the power source for UFOs based on their having harnessed the great sea of energy we live in? While the question has never been the subject of serious ufological investigation, I think he makes a respectable case for this possibility, and not just in theoretical terms. Can we say with certainty that his death was the result of a conspiracy or foul play on the part of MJ-12, the Food and Drug Administration, Soviet intelligence, the Communist Party, or those individuals in power who tend to mystify biology, then mechanically attempt to impose their own sex-negative morality on the rest of us? No. And the fact is that at the time of his death, Reich suffered from high blood pressure, was overweight, a chronic smoker, did not watch his diet, is true. But based on what he and his work represented to such diverse and powerful groups, among others, would it have been desired by these folks to have him dead? And would they have possessed the means of carrying this out? Well, of course, without a doubt. And unfortunately, the autopsy, the official cause of death was a heart attack. So I expect this will remain an open question. Now, I can only close by saying that I hope this paper will encourage some of you to seek out Reich's writings as opposed to writings about him and establish these truths for yourself. While the most recent of the accounts I've described linger some 50 years in the past, they continue to remain as crucially important and as relevant as if they had occurred last week. Many of us Americans are not particularly noted for seeking out the darker corners of our past, but we would be well advised here and in other areas. In the words of George Santayana, those who ignore history are doomed to repeat it. Thank you for your attention.